This is Radio Times from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Exploding airbags, defective ignition switches, gas leaks. Overall, 2014 has seen a record number of automotive recalls. We're going to start by updating the airbag story. There's word this week that Nissan is now recalling an additional 52,000 vehicles because of defective and dangerous airbags. Nissan, Honda, Toyota, Mazda, as many as 9 different automakers are affected. There are reports that the manufacturer, Takata, knew about the problem a decade ago, and a group of senators now wants the Justice Department to conduct a criminal investigation. And even if a consumer gets a recall notice, there's such a backlog of orders, it could take months to get the repair done. Our guest for the first half hour is Micheline Maynard, former Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. She is a contributor to Forbes and author of the book, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Micheline, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Mary.
So let's tackle the nuts and bolts first. What exactly happens when the Takata airbag in question malfunctions?
So there's two things that could happen. I mean, first of all, it could malfunction when you have an accident. So these airbags are generally on the passenger side of the vehicle. And when an airbag explodes, it is an explosion. There is an ignition that goes on in the bag, but the bag is supposed to inflate. You are supposed to be spared, hopefully, by the airbag inflating. What's been happening is two things. First of all, the airbag not only inflates but explodes and sends shards through the car. And in some instances, there have been episodes of airbags spontaneously combusting. So not an accident, the airbag just accidentally inflates.
And it's on the passenger side, but it can affect the driver as well if it explodes.
Oh, of course, because, you know, you're in an enclosed environment, and if things go flying inside the car, you know how it is when just a pen or a bee or something gets inside the car. We're talking about shards of metal and fabric.
So what is Takata saying the problem is?
So Takata actually knows what the problem is, and these are airbags that were designed for vehicles generally built between 2000 and 2008, and I don't know if people remember back then, but we were starting to see the thing come about called a smart airbag, where sensors would basically run the airbag rather than just the collision of the airbag. So the sensors would basically say, oh, I need to inflate this much because the collision force was this much. But that technology was a little bit, I hate to use the word screwy, but it was a little bit, unreliable, and that's been one of the issues with this. And I will say that there have been concerns about this airbag situation for 6 years. This is a known problem, and it's not a new problem.
Well, yeah, my understanding is the first reported airbag explosion happened 10 years ago. I mean, and this is way back, and an injury resulted to the driver. I mean, how did the automotive industry and the government react at the time, if at all?
Well, it was interesting because at first the airbag was seen to be an issue with humidity. So if you were in the southern United States, if you were in Guam, if you were in the islands, the Caribbean islands, it was thought that somehow humidity was getting inside of the vehicle and affecting the implementation of this airbag. And so that's how it was viewed, as a humid area problem. Well, as you know, living in Philadelphia, and living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, we can have humidity too.
Sure.
We can have lots of humidity in the summer. So only in the last couple of years has this scrutiny been expanded from the southern states to all states. But unfortunately, regulators just took a while to catch up to that.
Well, is the recall limited to the southern states?
Oh, no. Not at all. It was original. So there have been other recalls for this. I think we're now in phase 4 or so of these recalls. But initially, recalls were limited to the southern states. And in the last couple of months, it's been very clear that this was more of a national issue and not just a southern state issue.
Mickey Maynard, how does the recall process work?
Well, generally, a recall happens. First of all, you mostly have almost all recalls are voluntary recalls. So the car maker collects data on problems. The government collects data on problems. investigations begin. And depending on what's found, generally the government says to the car makers, you know, this is very casual, but we think you ought to consider a recall. They're not ordered to do so, but most recalls are voluntary because the evidence piles up and the automaker orders a recall. Generally, what happens is that you receive a notice from your car company. So if you have a Toyota, you would get a notice from Toyota saying, go to your dealership. They should have parts. You can get your car fixed for free. Now, what has been happening is that people have been told your car is being recalled and dealers don't have the parts. And they're waiting. And that's more frustrating than you can imagine for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, that's an impossible situation. What do you do?
Well, a lot of people are told, you know, we'll have the parts, say, next week. After next week, you can call and make an appointment to have your car fixed. Some people are actually notified again by the car companies that now it's the time to come in and get your car fixed. A lot of people get these letters and just throw them away. For whatever reason, we have a very low rate of people actually getting cars repaired after recalls in the United States.
Really?
And it's something that's very concerning to the federal government and concerning to the car companies because they don't want to open themselves up for liability. If they've told you there's a defect and you don't go get the car fixed, you know, you don't give up the right to sue them if you eventually feel that you want to.
Ah. So what happens, let's get back to the time lag. And for instance, with this airbag recall, I was told, we have a car in our family that was in question at one point, that it could take months to get this car fixed. And I know Toyota is now recommending that you disable that particular airbag and just put a little sticker on it saying, do not sit in the passenger seat. That's one solution. But really, should the car makers should they give you a loaner if they don't have the parts for the duration of the time that you have to wait so that you're traveling safely?
Well, one of the problems that we're running into here is that there are just so many vehicles involved. And dealers are not in the business to provide loaners. They're in the business to sell you cars. So it's not like dealers have a lot of extra cars sitting around so that the millions of people with possibly defective airbags can go in and get a car for however long it's going to take. The one thing I'd like listeners to understand is that an airbag is a very expensive component of a vehicle. It costs about $100 at the very cheapest wholesale level, and that's $100 on a vehicle that has 10,000 parts. So even a part that costs 50 cents or a dollar is expensive when you're talking about building millions of vehicles. And so there's an enormous expense to producing the replacement airbags because Takata also produces airbags that are put into contemporary cars. So they have to gear up their assembly lines to not only build these replacement airbags, but also keep other car makers stocked with current airbags.
And the more recent... Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that adds to the delay situation as well.
And the more recent Takata airbags, there are no complaints with those?
We have not heard many complaints of those, but I actually noticed that a couple of the recalls are for more current vehicles than the 2000 to 2008. I believe the Honda Odyssey, the Honda Element is a little bit more recent. They've actually included 2011 vehicles in that one.
Let's look into the government and its relationship to the automobile industry. Another big story, obviously, this year was the GM story and the ignition switch defect, which is linked, I think, now to 32 deaths. But an investigation by the New York Times has found that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration was frequently slow to see problems, can be hesitant to act, and even then reluctant to employ its full legal powers against the companies. In your opinion, is that a fair characterization?
I used to work for the New York Times.
I know.
I definitely trust my colleagues and my former colleagues. Here's the thing about NHTSA. So this is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. This is the branch of the Transportation Department that takes in your complaints about your vehicles and sifts through them to see if they're serious. So anyone can file a complaint about their car, and I've actually read through thousands of these complaints, and sometimes it's clearly someone who didn't read their owner's manual. You know, you read some of them and say, it's probably on page 33. Some of them are very serious complaints, and I think that's what is at issue with both the General Motors ignition switches, the exploding airbags, and the problems that popped up on Toyota about 5 years ago with sudden acceleration. Mm-hmm. The complaints come in. There's raw data. Then someone has to go through and categorize all these complaints. Some of it is done automatically by computer, but you still need people to go through, analyze the complaints. You need engineering tests. You need people to converse with the car companies and say, this is what we found. How does it match what you found? Then it has to go to the legal department, and then there's an opportunity for negotiation between the government and the car companies. So absolutely no piece of this is automatic, and when you have human beings involved, it's going to slow things down.
Well, let's talk about that word negotiation. I mean, NHTSA can force recalls, correct? But it just doesn't use its power to do so very often.
Right. So it absolutely can force recalls. But as I said, 99% of all recalls are voluntary recalls, because the government has always felt it's much more effective if the car company acknowledges and fixes the problem. It also avoids legal entanglements that can take years. So that is why NHTSA always aims for voluntary recalls rather than take a car company to court. I don't think this can be blamed on either the Obama administration or the Bush administration, you know, or any administration. Mm-hmm. There has been an attitude at NHTSA of letting the car companies own up and own these problems. And yes, I do believe that it has led to slower litigation, slower implementation of some of these recalls, simply because NHTSA is a very small entity versus the size of these car companies. And we are talking about 26 different car companies from around the world that sell vehicles in the United States. So it's really hard for this pretty small organization to keep track of all those vehicles.
Well, if this organization had the funding and the staff that it needed, do you think the airbag and the ignition switch recalls would have blown up the way they did?
I think they could have been dealt with faster. I definitely think the ignition switch situation could have been dealt with faster, except for one thing. General Motors says that even it didn't know what was going on with the ignition switches until 2013. So they didn't even have the paper trail. So NHTSA could have gone to GM and said, hey, we're finding this in the way GM was set up. GM wouldn't have been able to find it. You know, that's a problem right there, because there were things that were not discussed at General Motors during the ignition switch recall. And with the airbag thing, I think deserves more scrutiny, because we knew that it was out there, and yet very little was done about it.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment. Micheline Maynard is director of the Donald W. Reynolds National Center for Business Journalism at Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Back in just a moment. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowain. We're taking a look at auto recalls this half hour of Radio Times. Our guest is Mickey Maynard, former Detroit bureau chief for The New York Times. And if you have questions or comments for us, you can call 1-888-477-9499. An email works just as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Mickey, you also say that despite the record-breaking number of recalls, there is no need for consumers to panic.
Well, I don't think consumers should panic, but I do think consumers should be vigilant. So I know of instances where I have a Toyota Prius and I've gotten recall letters, and sometimes the recall letters are very specific, and they say that if you have a headlight that didn't function and you went in and got the headlight replaced on your own dollar, come back to us because this has been recalled. You know, so I've never had a problem with the headlight, and I just ignore the recall notice. But there are some more serious recall notices. So for a couple of years ago, when we had Toyota with the sudden acceleration thing, they asked all of us to come in and get our accelerator pedals looked at. I was one of the first people that went in, obviously, because I'd been covering the story. And that's what I would say to anyone who has a vehicle with the GM ignitions or anyone who has one of these vehicles. When your number comes up, get yourself into this showroom, because this is the thing you can do to protect yourself the most.
It's important to make the time.
Absolutely. Now, about turning off your passenger side airbag and putting a sticker on that nobody should sit in the passenger side. Now, that's not very practical for a lot of Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, we fill up our cars. We have people who carpool. But if you are driving alone, I think it would be a good idea to maybe put a bag of groceries or some shopping bags or something on the passenger side seat, maybe as a reminder that nobody should be sitting in that seat for a while.
Sure. But again, you know, if you do get into an accident, it can deploy, correct?
Well, that's true. And remember, this is a very, very small number of these vehicles that have had these issues. The problem is that when it occurs, it can be very, very disturbing to read some of the stories about the injuries that have taken place. So it's always better to be safe.
Oh, absolutely. And my son has one of the cars, which was in question. It's no longer. But when I first heard about it, you know, your mind immediately goes to the worst scenario. So better be safe than sorry.
Yeah. And I really don't want people to stop driving just because of this. I don't think it's a stop driving kind of an issue. Mm. But if you are feeling nervous, I would ask a mechanic to turn off your passenger side airbag if you have one of the cars in the recall. There's no need to do so if you don't have one of the cars in the recall.
Generally, you say that it's important to keep your car healthy, and that means regular maintenance.
Yes. So one of the things that we find out when we do regular maintenance is that sometimes there are other things going on with your car. For example, your mechanic you might have gone in for an oil change, or you might have gone in for a 100,000-mile checkup, and they look at your tires and they say, you know, your tires are practically bald. And we're coming up on bad weather, not here in Arizona, of course, but in the Midwest and in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic. So when you hear them say things like that to you, I would check it out myself. I mean, you can see if there's tread that's low on your tires. You know when it's time to go in for an oil change. There is the just prescribed maintenance in the owner's manual. You know, one of the things I would recommend for people is just read your owner's manual. Most people don't. They basically take the cars, get the keys, and put the owner's manual in the glove box. So I think if you have a little extra time, maybe this weekend, just sit down and read through your owner's manual, and you'll learn a lot.
Okay. Let's change focus for just a moment, Mickey. The way we buy cars is changing, and this is kind of fascinating. You know, the car dealership has been around since the early 20th century, and state laws which protect that model have also been around for a long time. But I'm wondering if this model is a dinosaur. We're reading up on Tesla Motors, which, wants to sell directly to customers through the web and its own stores. Some states are okay with this. New Jersey is not. It blocked Tesla's efforts to set up shop in March. Why not sell online?
Well, a lot of car companies, if Tesla were able to make progress on getting a lot of states to allow it to sell online, I think the car companies would like to line up right behind it. But we have very strong dealer lobbies in this country. We have a series of state franchise laws that are intended to protect franchise car dealers. And in a way, you can't blame them, because it costs a minimum of $1 million and probably more to open up one of those showrooms. They are employing dozens of people, from the mechanics to the folks who sit at the desks to the finance departments to the people who sell you parts. And so these are business people who want to protect their way of doing business. I think one of the things that bothers me the most about the car buying dealership is sort of the theater that goes on. And I would recommend that any of your listeners who like This American Life go back in their archives and look at the visit that they paid to a Chrysler dealer earlier this year, because it was very illuminating on the whole theater of buying a car and financing a car.
Oh, I'll have to do that. And the National Automobile Dealers Association does counter that most Americans can't just cough up the money to buy a car over the internet. They need the financing, and maybe they're trading in an old vehicle, which is a valid argument.
It's a valid argument for the way they do business, absolutely. And if you have a trade-in, You have two choices. You can sell it yourself, which means you have to be home when everybody comes by to look at the car, mm-hmm. or you can take it to a dealer for it to be assessed, and that definitely is a convenience. The one thing I'd say about buying a vehicle online is that Tesla is operating in a very thin layer of the most ultra-luxury vehicles in our country. They're selling electric sedans that cost $70,000, and you kind of feel like they should be able to get an exemption simply because that's not going to compete with a Chevy truck or a Ford sure. F-150. So why not give Tesla, which is really a specialty vehicle, sort of an exemption from the franchise dealership rule? But, you know, laws are laws, and dealers have spent a lot of money over the years to protect those franchises.
Just wanted to touch base on one more story before we wrap up. Apparently, the price of electric cars and hybrids is coming down. According to USA Today, the battery-powered Focus Electric is now selling for just under $30,000, and that doesn't include the tax incentives. So what's happening?
So a couple things are happening with electric vehicles. First of all, they're smaller electric vehicles than the Tesla Model S sedan. You have the Nissan Leaf, you have Toyota, you have some other electric vehicles out there. You also have the realization that people who buy electric vehicles are not necessarily going to be the wealthiest folks in town. A lot of environmentalists would like to own them and would like to have the convenience. You're also seeing electric vehicle charging stations much more widely available than they once were. If you drive into pretty much any city garage now in any major city, you'll probably see an electric charging station. So as electrics become more common, the price does come down, and in fact, Tesla is planning to introduce an electric sport utility vehicle and an electric smaller car, and they have very ambitious goals to someday sell as many as 500,000 electric vehicles a year. Hmm. So once they're out there, the prices will definitely come down.
Yeah, and I guess if you were going to consider buying something like an electric or a hybrid, probably the time to do it is before gas prices go back up again.
That's right, and it's unbelievable here in Arizona. You know, gas is well under $3 a gallon, and I don't remember seeing that since I was in school, I don't think. So I have a Prius, and I only have to fill it up about once a month, and I'm just amazed that now I'm paying, you know, $20 and less, basically, to top off my tank.
Yes, we're enjoying the break here in the Delaware Valley as well. Mm-hmm. Mickey Maynard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I've been happy to be with you.
Mickey Maynard is former Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. And we're going to take a very different tack now for the back half of the show and check out what's coming down the pike. Some new and fascinating automotive technologies. Here with the update is John Davis, host and executive producer of Motor Week, the television series, which is produced by Maryland Public Television and airs on PBS stations nationwide. John, welcome.
Thanks, Mary. Delighted to be with you.
So let's start off by talking about some of the new models making their debuts. The Ford F-150.
Well, that's easily going to be the single most talked about vehicle for the next probably 6 months or so. These days, a vehicle doesn't stay in the limelight very long. But the gist of it is that the F-150 is revolutionary in the fact it's the first high-volume vehicle that's going to have an all-aluminum body. And I mean, there's several European vehicles out there that they build 20, 30,000 a year, but we're talking 700,000 full-size pickups. And this is the best-selling vehicle in North America for over a generation, and they're making a wholesale switch to aluminum, basically to save fuel economy. It cuts about 700 pounds from the weight. So it's a huge gamble for Ford, but it's probably, to use the Ford term, the way forward for the whole U.S. auto industry.
Would you go as far as to call this a fuel sipper?
I think it will be to a point.
It's a little much.
This is obviously a pickup truck.
Yeah.
The best out there right now in a full-size truck is a Dodge Ram with a diesel engine, and it gets about 28 miles per gallon on the highway, which most everybody expects that the F-150, when they release the numbers, their best will be right at that level, about 28 on the highway, and maybe a little bit better than the diesel in the city. So, you know, compared to the best cars out there, this is hardly a step forward, but it's a giant step forward for big trucks.
Well, you said that Ford is taking a gamble. Why a gamble?
Yeah. No one's ever built an aluminum-bodied vehicle in this kind of number. When Ford owned Jaguar and Land Rover, Range Rover, they engineered aluminum-bodied vehicles there that are in production. And Audi has been making aluminum-bodied vehicles, all aluminum vehicles, for quite a while. But you're talking 10, 20,000, maybe 30,000 units a year. This is 700,000 units a year in two different factories. This is a monumental undertaking. And when you're dealing with the best-selling vehicle in the country, and also, I must say, the thing that the vehicle that makes the giant amount of profit for Ford, it's an enormous gamble because truck buyers are fairly conservative and, you know, they may not want to switch, but Ford's been very successful at taking new technology like V6 engines and replacing V8s in their pickup trucks. They've taken risks before, but none quite as giant as this.
Okay, so we're also going to see a trend in more family sedans?
What's happening this year, we just finished wrapping up with our partners at Cars.com and USA Today a comparison of 10 mid-size family sedans. And this is really the core of the family vehicle market in this country. These cars are evolving rapidly. They're becoming larger on the inside without any great gain in size outside. Fuel economy with standard engines, highway cruising in the 30-mile-per-gallon range, which is about 10 mpg better than a decade ago. Very impressive vehicles loading up on new safety technology. They're almost luxurious, even down at the lower levels of trim. We're very impressed with what we're seeing from all across the board. And when you look at mainstays like the Toyota Camry, relative newcomers like the Hyundai Sonata, and then cars that were kind of marginalized before, like the Subaru Legacy, it's pretty impressive what's going on.
And SUVs are shrinking?
Yes, that's the other big trend that is starting to become widespread. Not just small SUVs, but really small SUVs, subcompact SUVs.
Why?
We've seen them from, well, it started with fuel economy, but now people are saying, you know, rather than buy a subcompact, quote-unquote, car, why don't I add something with all-wheel drive to it and basically give myself a little bit more flexibility in bad weather, and it doesn't have to be snowing, maybe just the heavy rains. So many came out with the Countryman and sort of paved the way. Buick's been very successful with the imported Encore, a subcompact SUV. And now Chevrolet has one coming out early next year called the Trax, which is based on the same chassis as the Encore. It's probably going to do very, very well.
All right, let's get to some of the fun futuristic stuff. Toyota says it'll be the first to offer high-tech crash avoidance systems on all its cars and trucks in 2017. So what are they talking about here, John?
They're talking about a suite of technologies, and I should point out that all of this new active safety technology that's emerging, and we're talking about things that will keep you in your lane, lane keep assist, automatic braking, radar-based speed control. All of these are technologies that are needed to make the autonomous self-driving car a reality. And, you know, we've been talking about self-driving cars for quite a while. We've seen the Google experiments that have gotten a lot of widespread recognition. But the automakers actually have been working on this stuff for a long time. But it was up at the upper end, you know, the Mercedes S-Class and things of that ilk. Now you can buy these technologies on a Subaru, on a Buick, on a Toyota, you name it. So they've come downstream into the main marketplace very, very quickly.
So when does a self-driving car actually happen?
We're probably, you know, a lot of it's going to be dictated by legalities. But to answer your question directly, 18 months from now, both Cadillac and Audi will have self-driving cars on the market that will be able to drive themselves in crowded, slow, commuter, stop-and-go traffic. And in the Cadillac case, it'll also be able to drive itself under some conditions at highway speeds. So if they get it right, and I'm telling you, there can be no mistakes here.
Yeah.
We're probably a year and a half away from some form of self-driving car.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't know about you, John, but I'm feeling that that's exciting and yet really scary. Am I wrong to feel a little apprehensive?
I think I do. I have very mixed feelings about it. I love to drive, so the idea of a computer taking over all of the driving functions doesn't amuse me. But, you know, it'd be a huge boon for people that have disabilities. It may help them retain their driving capabilities longer. So there are a lot of upsides to this. But, yeah, I mean, we're not talking about dedicated lanes. We're talking about, you know, in the midst of normal traffic, you taking your hands off the wheel and feet off the pedals and sitting back and, I guess, reading the newspaper or whatever else you might want to do and letting the car take over.
Let's kind of break this up a little bit because we're seeing, as you said, bits and pieces of this starting to appear in models. Automatic braking, how does that work?
Automatic braking primarily uses either radar or sonar or a camera or a combination of the both to take a look at the vehicle in front of you, either when you're on speed control or just normal driving. And if it figures out that you're closing too rapidly on that car to stop, it will give you a lot of warning at first. Lights will flash and there'll be all sorts of sirens. But if that doesn't get your attention, it will actually apply the brake. Now, the best systems out there will brake you from about 25 to 30 miles per hour to a complete stop. They won't necessarily stop you if you're going, you know, 50, 60 miles an hour, but they will slow you down. Some of the systems out there don't do quite that well. They will simply knock off about 10 or 15 miles per hour and expect you to pick it up from there. But inevitably, we are heading towards a vehicle very soon that from normal highway speeds, if you are not paying attention, will stop you completely to help you avoid an accident.
We'll pick up on that in just a moment. We're taking a look at fascinating automotive technologies on the way. John Davis is our guest, host and executive producer of Motor Week, the television series. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and for Marty Moskowane, we'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowane. We're talking about the car of the future, and actually bits and pieces of it are here right now. John Davis is our guest. He is host and executive producer of Motor Week, the television series, which is produced by Maryland Public Television. And as always, we welcome your input. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. John, vehicle-to-vehicle communication sounds futuristic, but, you know, it's coming, if not already here. What is that exactly?
V2V, as it's known, basically works very much like mid-air collision warning systems do on aircraft. If you're flying in a commercial airplane today, it has units on board that if there's another airplane in the vicinity, it lets the pilot know. And under extreme conditions, like if they're going to have a head-on collision, it will give instructions to the two planes to take different paths to avoid the collision. We're talking about a future with cars that will be very similar to that. If you're entering an intersection and you're doing the right thing, if another car happens to be running a red light, it's going to alert your car and potentially put on the brakes to try and avoid the collision or maybe even steer you out of the way. The full V2V operation is a little ways down the pike, but again, in about 18 months, we're going to start seeing it show up on the first cars on the market. It'll be a long while, though, I think, before it becomes truly useful, because obviously if the other car doesn't have it, it's not going to do you much good.
Mm-hmm. Does this bring about the question of computer security as data is being exchanged via a wireless system, two cars, people don't know each other? Is that a concern?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about the hacker aspect of it. I'm not too concerned about one car talking to another or about any kind of privacy situation. I am very concerned, though, if somebody can get inside of your car. But if you're moving, that would be particularly difficult to do, you would think, unless someone's beside you. But as we've seen with every other technology improvement in computers, there's somebody out there waiting to find a way to basically ruin it. So I would be very concerned about it.
Let's get an update on voice control technology. It turns out that talking to your dashboard is a frustrating experience for many drivers. And researchers at the University of Utah conducted a study and found significant cognitive distraction while people wrestled with voice commands. That's not good.
No, it's not. I mean, basically, they found the voice command systems just as distracting as looking at screens and trying to hit the right icon on the screen. I certainly can tell you from my experience, we test 150 cars a year. I always get in a vehicle with voice commands and give it fairly simple instructions because I'm assuming that most people don't read their owner's manual, as you heard Mickey Maynard previously say. It's correct. And, you know, give it simple commands like, Jane, go to a certain radio station, and, you know, the chances that it's going to do it the first, second, or even third time are fairly small. So I like these systems. I think they hold a lot of promise to cut down on driver distraction, but they're a long way from being there yet.
So automakers are tweaking them?
Automakers are tweaking them, and I think to some degree they may have been hamstrung by legal issues. But right now they've got to make these systems so that if you pop into it and you speak in a normal voice and you say something that makes sense, it's going to recognize it. So it is computer. It's how much memory these cars can carry around inside of them. So it's all, you know, processor-based and software-based. They've made a lot of progress. Siri is great. But it's not there.
Hmm. I like this, a car that finds its own parking space and picks you up later.
Well, yeah, Ford actually has we've had self-parking cars around for quite a while. And frankly, most of the systems, I don't think, are worth the bother. But Ford has come up with a system that they are marketing primarily in Europe, but it'll be here later this year, where if you find a pull-in parking spot, head-in spot that's very, very narrow, that the car will park itself, and you, in some cases in Europe, you're actually able to get out of the car because their spaces are so narrow that you can't open the doors once you get in it. And with your smartphone, pull the car into the spot, and when you come back, pull the car out. The system here won't be quite that sophisticated yet, but that's on the horizon.
John, do you recommend when these new technologies are available that consumers maybe wait a couple of years to see how if the kinks get ironed out?
Yeah, I do, and I don't even think you have to wait a couple years. Just wait for a competitor to come out with something better in about 3 to 6 months. We've seen the evolution. Say we were talking about radar braking or automatic braking. In 1 year's time, we saw BMW go from a system that was sort of okay, it slowed you down, to one that really worked and stopped you. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety has done a lot of testing in this area, and they right now, frankly, are the go-to people when you want to see how one of these systems works better than another.
We have a comment from Bill, and he asks, will we have a choice to not have a car that does all these futuristic things?
We will if the government doesn't come in and start mandating it like they already have with stability control. Right now, these systems are offered usually on the top trim level, so they are kind of pricey, but we do expect them to work their way down. I think, though, that you probably will be able to buy a fairly wide number of moderately priced cars without these features if you don't want them.
It almost feels as if, as a driver, you're relinquishing maybe a little bit too much control.
Well, I personally think you are. I think most people that are in my business who love to drive really don't like this trend at all. But you can't deny that this is going to make a safer environment. And we are putting, you know, net about 10 million more vehicles on the road every year. So we've probably got to do something.
Okay. Let's talk about turbocharging, which, of course, used to be associated with muscle cars. But now, now automakers are looking at it with an eye toward fuel efficiency.
Absolutely. One of the main ways that the automakers expect to meet at least the early parts of the current fuel economy standards for the next 4 or 5 years is by going to smaller engines. But they know the American public will not accept a pokey vehicle or, for that matter, a smaller one than what they're used to. So they are using smaller engines with turbocharging to keep the power up and the feel as you first hit that pedal up. And at the same time, because the engines are smaller, they're using less fuel. It's a big cry from, say, 20 years ago when turbos, as you pointed out, were performance-oriented and, frankly, not very reliable. The turbos today are very reliable, and you're going to find them in just about anything with four wheels in the next few years.
And the fuel economy can come close to that of a hybrid?
I wouldn't put it quite that high, but it's certainly for less complexity. It gives you basically the fuel economy of a four-cylinder and the power of a V6 and maybe even a V8. So it gets you into that highway cruising for a normal-size automobile, a mid-size car, mm-hmm. of 30-plus miles per gallon. You obviously could do better with hybrids. But I also think the hybrid technology is going to work its way down to almost every vehicle, but that'll probably remain an option because it's more expensive.
What percentage of the market is hybrid now? Do you have a ballpark?
Oh, it's not very large. It's I'm off the top of my head, I think it's 4 or 5%, if that. And that may take in the electric too. It's mm-hmm. I mean, really, you have Toyota, who's been very successful, and then you have everybody else who's been moderately successful.
And one more point on the turbocharging: if you have a lead foot, this can affect your fuel efficiency.
The biggest thing you can do for fuel economy is to drive stably, to basically not to get away from jump starts or stops, to be very easy on the pedal. We tell people pretend there's a hard-boiled egg under there, under your foot, and just do things gently and progressively. But absolutely, spiking the pedal, either for braking or accelerating, really costs you in fuel economy.
And we have a comment from Bill. He asks, why are we not able to buy the small diesel-powered cars in the U.S. that are available in Europe?
A couple of reasons. The Europeans basically subsidize diesel fuel to make it cheaper than gasoline. They have less tax on diesel. So they make it, first of all, very attractive, something we have not done in this country, either at the federal or state level. The second reason is their diesels are dirtier than our laws will allow, and only now are they starting to bring in some truly clean diesels that meet the U.S. standards. America's just not a diesel country, and with the other fact that diesel refining capacity is so limited, as you noted earlier, we've got gas prices falling, but diesel prices haven't fallen nearly as quickly and probably won't.
I thought I'd read someplace that there are efforts to make it cleaner and the engine quieter as well.
Oh, yeah.
It might be a resurgence might be on the horizon here. Is that not the case in your opinion?
No, I think it is, but only for certain vehicles. We're going to see diesels pretty much. They have to become stronger in the truck and SUV markets because that's the only way they're going to meet some of the fuel economy standards. And even if we have a change in administration in a couple of years, mm-hmm. a lot of these fuel economy standards through at least the year 2020 are set and are not likely to be altered. This is not something that's just a Democratic thing. This push for higher fuel economy actually started at the end of the Bush administration.
Sure. I didn't realize this, but diesels have been turbocharged since the 1970s.
Oh, yes. The first diesels before that I can remember driving were so slow. You had to do something because initially a diesel doesn't develop a great deal of power. It takes a little while for it to build up to its full strength. So you needed something to help it along, and that's where the turbochargers have done a remarkable job.
Back to modern-day efforts to bring back the turbocharger, it's not cheap. That's one of the negatives.
No. It's not cheap, and they used to be, you know, if you got 40, 50, 60,000 miles out of one before you spent a lot of money to replace them, you were doing well. But those turbochargers were basically ones that used oil, engine oil, to cool them. And when the engine was off, sometimes that they would still be spinning at a very rapid speed, and they would get starved for oil, and they would cause them to fail. Now the turbochargers are cooled with the same kind of coolant that cools the rest of your engine. They have pumps that keep it circulating. So the longevity has gone way up. Plus, most vehicles today have at least a 60,000-mile warranty on powertrain parts and many 100,000. So they're taking some of the potential sting out of it. But make no mistake, the more complicated we make powertrains, engines and transmissions, the more apt they are to cost a lot of money when they do fail.
Sure. And even though turbocharged engines can give you some fuel economy, they've always liked high-octane gas, which is more expensive, right?
Yes, that's true. And that is changing to some degree. There are a few turbocharged engines out there that will run on regular. But generally speaking, if you're going to go turbo, you've probably got to look at a high premium gas or at least mid-premium. But I do expect that with further electronic controls to see most of the newer turbo engines run just fine on regular, or at least you'll be able to do it without damaging the engine.
Let's check in again with the hybrid and the electric markets.
Right.
Is the hybrid model now, is that something that's not going to change much, or do you see it developing further?
Well, I think the next big step, there's a couple of steps for a hybrid that I think are in the wind. One will be the, and we are seeing it in some cases, advanced hybrids. And there I'm putting things like the Prius plug-in hybrid and also the Chevrolet Volt, where you've got the gasoline and you've got the battery, and you can also plug it in to get some range out of the battery without the gas engine ever running. I think that's, to some degree, will become a little bit more commonplace. But you're going to see basically hybrid technology just there as a helper. We talked about smaller engines. Suppose the engine is not turbocharged. Suppose it's just a normally aspirated 3- or 4-cylinder engine. What do you do to get that little bump in power? Well, maybe you put a little electric motor in there to help you when you're starting out or when you want to pass, and a tiny little battery that doesn't cost a whole lot of money to help it out. Also, all-wheel drive vehicles. Why do you have to have all of this hardware to connect the engine to the wheels that aren't driven when you could stick an electric motor and a small battery back there that's constantly being charged by the engine up front to get you through those slick spots during the winter? So I see electrification of cars becoming much more widely spread than we have today.
Mm-hmm. Subaru is jumping into the hybrid market with something called, it's the XV, I don't want to call it 15, it's Roman numerals, XV Crosstrek?
Yeah, the Crosstrek is a nice little all-wheel drive vehicle that's based on a compact car, but the Impreza. And they've added a small, a rather modest hybrid system to it. We, at first, were not that crazy about it because, frankly, it doesn't improve fuel economy that much. But in the end, it makes the vehicle so much more drivable. And it does just what I was talking about. It makes basically a small SUV more capable, more fuel efficient than it would be without it. So it's actually a pretty good step for them. It doesn't cost, but it's a couple of grand more than a regular one. So it's not crazy money. But I think that's their toe in the water, and I would expect the next one to be much more adventuresome.
So which auto...
They're partially owned by Toyota, so you would think they've got the access to the technology.
So, John, which automakers had a really strong 2014?
Well, I think if you would look at the numbers as far as the domestics, clearly it's Chrysler. They've had the longest string of up months they've ever had in their history. GM has done pretty good, Ford less well, but not bad. The imports, though, have done very well. Toyota's done extremely well. Honda's done well. So, once again, we've seen more market share gained by the imports, but Chrysler is on a heck of a roll, and nobody really sees that stopping anytime soon.
And car sales overall this year are pretty strong?
They're strong. They're going to be about 16.5 million by the time it's all done. I'm concerned they can't keep that pace up. Right now, a lot of it's being fueled by 7-year loans, which are just boggle my mind, 0% financing and very generous leases.
So 7 years, huh?
Not for me. That's John, a long time to be paying for a car.
Yep. John Davis, it was great having you with us on Radio Times.
Mary, thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
John is host and executive producer of Motor Week, the television series. And remember, you can head to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including our Facebook page and podcasts. Kevin Griffin is our engineer today. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. Quinn Lipson is our intern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.